Okay, hello, this is Bob Dobbs and Cameron McEwen with episode 69 of an ongoing series of analyzing my booklet. It's not a huge book, but it's not tiny, 200 pages or so, and we're doing page 139 if you're following us in detail. We're at the top of page 139, and let's see what it says. We are doing part 4, Android Meme Phase 2. But before we go into that, Cameron was talking to me a few minutes ago about his approach as synchrony and my approach as diachrony. So we talked about this at the beginning, and it's a difference that Cameron said was happening with the two of us, me being diachrony, and Cameron being synchrony. So I thought after a couple of years of talking, I'd like to hear Cameron say the difference now and see if it's changed by our talking, because we have sort of gotten closer and overlap closer than how we started. So what is the synchrony that you're doing, and with my charts and sequences, phases, which you're calling chronological or historical? How is that not synchrony, or
no? It is synchronous. For example, your tiny note chart. You don't believe that that's something that happened once upon a time, and now it doesn't apply anymore.
Right.
You think that the tiny note chart applies all the time.
Yes.
So the only place where we have a marked difference is in what McEwen calls pre-tribal awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And you tend to cache that in terms of sort of isolated individuals strolling the earth, and they don't yet belong to society. Whereas I say that pre-tribal awareness is how experience gets generated at every moment of time, by every human, qua being a human being. That exercising pre-tribal awareness is simply creativity, and creativity is simply the fact that humans are at every moment exposed to various possibilities of reaction.
So if we imagine that before social groupings, these isolated individuals, they encounter each other, they don't have a common language, they communicate in some way, Zappa called them the grunt people, they grunt. How is the grunting synchronous?
Well, you see, you're putting that in historical terms.
Yeah.
So you could say that insofar as individuals meet each other and grunt and don't have a common language, then they're not yet human. And what, as McEwen often says, the ability to use language and the fact of human being, those are the same things. There's no such thing as human beings that don't have language.
Mm.
So the human beings are inherently social in the sense that they are constantly visiting the possibilities of expression. And by expression, I don't just mean words. I mean how people experience. For McEwen, experience is an extension or an expression of a human being. And so the if you think of speaking language, there's always a whole bunch of different words, a whole bunch of different sounds, a whole bunch of different gestures that a human being can utter. So that collectivity is already there for all humans.
Well, okay.
Go ahead.
No such thing as?
There's no such thing as an isolated grunt being that is already a human.
Okay, so the grunt people meet, and they're being creative in responding to each other, interpreting each other, but they haven't locked into any social agreed upon assumptions or, you know, force enforcements. So there's a difference. When they do get into socialization, they still have that, quote, alienation or separateness or whatever, that's private, unreachable part of the self, the private citadel of consciousness that media can't access. That is there, right? It's always there.
Yes.
And maybe it's always been the same. So I include that. Does that make me synchronous?
Yes, if you're seeing that all human experience is artistic, and it's in the sense that it's the expression of that pre-tribal awareness, then of course, right? It's like if we say in Bob's tiny note chart are the different junctions between the five people in the chart, and or the six people in the chart, however you want to read it, are the junctions between those people, and in the different topics that they cover, are those things always possibilities for all humans? And the answer is yes.
Yeah. So the once you start talking about the way creativity is limited by the social structures, and McLuhan's simple chronology is you have speech-based, maybe audio-tactile, then you have eye-based, then you have kinetic-based with industry, and then you have the software-based of the electric environment. That's a sequence. Is that diachrony?
Yes.
Now, I would say we have the Elliott statement. I got to use words when I talk to you, but when I write a book, back in McLuhan's day, I got to make it diachrony,
yes,
or logical, that the book is sequential. It's going to force that. And he knew that,
sure,
and I knew that when I made my chart, that this is just a visualization. So it's not
that chronological time doesn't exist. It's the question is, what is the structure of chronological time? And the structure, according to McLuhan, is a kind of up and down wave. It's like a light wave or a sound wave that moves through time, but it does so having a vertical axis.
You mean like in the X and Y thing?
Well, it could be graphed, but I'm talking about if you imagine a radar screen.
Yeah.
And you've got this movement going up and down and up and down and up and down, but it's also moving horizontally. And so for McLuhan, the difficulty that he constantly talked about is how do you get to people to what he calls inclusive consciousness, that is to say, to a consciousness that's electric, to a consciousness that has built-in tactility, where there's different poles of the experience, but those poles are not considered to be antagonistic. They're differentiated, but they're joined. So for McLuhan, the great problem is to try to get people to understand what the possibilities and problems are of inclusive consciousness.
Right. So I have six phases or so: Global Village, Global Theater, Global Membrane, Android Meme Phase 1, Android Meme Phase 2. There are differences. So I'm highlighting the differences.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan spent his time in understanding media chronologically pointing out the obsolescence of chronology. And so the tight paradox is he's writing a book at a time where books are very weak in impact, but he prefers to do a book. He's going to use other media when he gets the opportunity.
Sure.
But he almost says, I'm going to retrieve sequential thinking again. through talking about the discontinuous simultaneous electric environments, which is a new percept, a new topic, something people don't know about. But
right.
I do bring back the book experience, he's saying.
Correct. Correct. He even says that that's bringing, this is a very complicated topic. So
yeah.
let's say on first, he certainly does try to retrieve the book experience, as you just put it.
Yeah.
But when the book experience is retrieved and replayed, it's not the same as what it was.
Yeah.
Right? So what McLuhan says is that if we are to understand media, we cannot understand them in isolation. We have to understand them in their plurality. So if we were to get ourselves engaged only with the book, then we're back in the Gutenberg galaxy and we have all the problems of that galaxy, namely,
yeah.
Ultimately an attack on the human personality, dedication to war. So he wants to get away from that. But at the same time, he says, look, if we go over to just the electric media, they have their own problems. And we end up with no mind if we go over there far enough. So the only way to avoid the pitfalls of both is to have inclusive consciousness. That is to say, we understand media in its synchronic plurality. And when we do that, we can offset the weakness of all of the different individual media through the understanding of media as a spectrum, as a whole theater of possibilities.
Right. So many people, McLuhan has been retrieved a lot the last 25 years, in journalism.
So they say.
Beg your pardon?
So they say.
Yeah, well, let me qualify that. So they bring his name up more than they did in the 80s. And,
yes.
You know, after the Berlin Wall went down and then the Internet comes in. And they talk in a ho-hum. Well, we know McLuhan said the medium is the message and we have a global village and media are extensions of our senses. They say a few principles.
Yep.
But I can go into – if I bring up McLuhan and start talking, I can quote – they won't know I'm quoting. I'll just start saying ideas that
yeah.
I got from McLuhan. For example, I remember talking to this woman, an art professor, in Halifax in the 70s, and I was telling her the reason black power happened, or civil rights, or just the preference, the popularity of the black image, black power and all that, was due to color television. She was outraged. What are you talking about? It was, you know, kids going down there, college kids going down and getting shot and registering to vote, all this practical voting stuff. And I said, yeah, but with the face of the black was way more charismatic on color TV than the white face. The white face was chiaroscuro. That was okay on black and white TV, but not on color TV. Now, she thought I was nuts. She didn't know McLuhan said that. But it was, to me, it was always an example of people have no clue how McLuhan applied himself to all kinds of topics that is never talked about, like that. And he said, civil rights will be a red herring. He says that in Cultures Our Business. And that's what Cornel West and those guys are saying like about 10 years ago. We have a new wealthy middle class, black bourgeois, but they have left their tribe back in the ghettos. And he said, there's something wrong here. We got the vote, we got access to jobs and that, but we're actually a fragmented cult of people now, you know, worse.
Oh, sure.
And I think that's what McLuhan was warning people about, that there would be a charisma for the black face, but then it would be tetraded and flip, and then it would be a reaction, and there would be a white backlash and all those problems. So there's any topic in the world. I mean, McLuhan's like Ann Landers, right? He discusses every problem of social dating or social relationships in all aspects through history and today. That's what I liked about
right.
it. You wanted to find out what do you think about streaking, say. He had a quote on it. So What is that? People aren't getting McLuhan. They don't get what I'm talking about. So why do people think they get McLuhan? Because they don't have an inclination to read him. It's almost like a boring idea or media extensions of our senses. Oh, yeah, that's a nice idea. Maybe think about things a little bit. But they don't get into the examples that he wrote about in many books.
Mm-hmm.
And actually,
that's right.
And he actually solved every social problem, at least as a statement, an intellectualization of what the issues were, clarified everything. And that never got understood, and you know that, and you're trying to improve that situation. But maybe I would ask, why would you think he failed that way? He never got his message across, or do none of the great philosophers ever get it across what they're doing?
Well, I think the latter.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not that McLuhan was without failures. I mean, he was a individual human being who he had a vocation to try to clarify certain ideas, and he did his best, and I think he did a fantastic job that people don't really appreciate. But at the same time, McLuhan often screwed up by mixing up the principles of the sort of analysis that he was trying to do and the application. And when people read McLuhan, they get mixed up between those things. They think that talking about media, for example, means this TV or this Walkman or whatever, whereas he's using them as examples. Right, and McLuhan is not very clear, unless he's read closely. McLuhan is not very clear about the difference between an example and the principles that underlie that example. So when you're talking about McLuhan, you are constantly aware of the sort of differences that you set out in the tiny note chart.
Yeah.
You're aware that there's nothing that ever occurs that is without tactility. Well, but that's at the level of principle. When people hear you and they hear you talking about tactility or they hear you talking about various events, they don't understand that you're talking at two levels at once.
Mm.
And so, yes, McLuhan is being retrieved in a sense, but he's being retrieved at a very simplistic reading.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's interesting in McLuhan is he says that there are solutions only in problems.
Yeah.
So if you consider the question, what is a medium? Well, once medium is considered as a question, it has become a message. There could be no clarification of what is a medium except through some medium. Right? And
yep.
Then if you say, well, what is that medium that's deeper? Well, now it's become a message. So the problem that people have in understanding McLuhan is that his understanding presupposes that we're grappling with very deep problems. For example, infinite regress, when the question of what is a medium is put forward. Or there's the question of, you often quote Take Today, where McLuhan says that with with the electric environment, the whole system is blown up. It implodes.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean for individual identity? What does it mean for the family? What does it mean for social identity, all this sort of stuff? When these things implode, what's the implication? Well, these kinds of problems lie at the base of what McLuhan was doing, and there's no solution in the McLuhan sense that doesn't get back to those problems. But the normal reading of McLuhan is to avoid those problems.
Okay, so so I come up with this idea of the Android meme. That I'm trying to describe there's something different going on than what McLuhan described. He got as far as software communism. But then the speed up, the perfecting of even more media communication and hoiking up the individual to have more access to everything leads to a whole bunch of new post-sensory ratios. We don't even have the senses happening anymore. So I was saying that the technology started to extend themselves, not our senses anymore. So I was saying I thought I had a new mandate to point out that McLuhan went so far, but there's a whole new situation where you can't just apply his common principle that media extension of our senses. That doesn't apply in the new situation. Now, Eric comes up in 98 or so in his book Electric Language that we are extending different parts of the brain with computers. So he still brings it back to the human body. But I thought I was going a bit further than that and not. Because since people didn't really know anything about computers, they just used them, and there was a lot of confusion about them, but that was suppressed. People didn't talk about it. They just typed away and tried to keep up with communication with the tribe. And but their confusion is that what are computers extending? If you do it simply, naively, you'd say, oh, the central nervous system or something. But there was something different being extended to the point people didn't know what was being extended. They understood that books extend the eye. But once we get into the area I call the Android meme, it's a new situation. So what do I is that? Am I trying to point out a historical difference?
Seems like.
Okay.
Seems like when you emphasize historical difference, you're saying that chronology has some sort of principal effect on human being.
Yeah.
And my difference with that is that I say the chronological expression of human being always depends upon the interior landscape, the global village within, that it is what gets expressed over time. So what the differences in time that you're talking about, I see as qualities or properties of a prior dynamic, mm-hmm. Civil War of Media, as you sometimes call it.
Yeah.
Whereas you say that the time factor is more important.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it the time factor. I just say there's something different in the media. So. Do you think there's some that we did Android meme phase one? I was trying to describe something. Was I always really just doing McLuhan, but properly in a deeper mode, which is not done very much, and we didn't need a new term, Android meme, for a new phase?
Well, I guess I would just go back to Sweeney. I got to use words when I talk to you. I mean, you're trying to grapple with deep issues and how those issues get expressed, how a person attempts to communicate them varies. So what I see you doing is an engagement with McLuhan, and there's nothing wrong with saying, well, I'm going to go beyond McLuhan or something. I mean, if that may be a helpful way to look at certain things. But I just say that when people are engaged with McLuhan, they have to be engaged in these deeper issues. And if they're engaged with these deeper issues, as I believe you are, then what is said on the basis of those issues and as an expression of those issues is interesting. It's a way of trying to unfold what human beings need to unfold if they're going to get themselves out of the predicament that they've put themselves in. We've painted ourselves in a corner. We're in danger of wiping ourselves and everything else on the planet out. So how are we going to get out of this? And you're attempting to think through those issues. I'm attempting to think through those issues. And our conversation is, sort of a dialogue around that topic.
Right. So I coined the phrase Android meme in the late 90s. So 25 years ago. Is that 25? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 25. And, I was in this youth culture magazine called Flipside. And, mm-hmm. I put my diary entries in there, and I called it Android Meme Xenocrony. Nobody knew what those terms were. If I got to say them back then, people would just, what are you saying? I don't know that mm-hmm. stuff. They wouldn't. Just like when McLuhan comes up with media in the 50s, using that word, people didn't use the word, and he popularized it. So then media became part of the, I guess you call it the lingua franca, right? Just people were yep. saying it. They didn't really know what it meant, but the word had resonance and seemed to point to something new that was going on. So then I did Android Meme, and as I've said before, I picked the right word. Nobody thought, I didn't think, back in 1998, that 25 years later, the word meme would be a cliche and tossed around like McLuhan's media was eventually. So I hit yep. on the right word. Now, that's an interesting, that's a poetic function, isn't it? I called
it. Yes, it is.
And you got the right name, or the name did surface as the preferred name. Like, people don't say, well, we're doing this virtuality or that virtuality. They say memeing. Now, I was talking to somebody, and the meme is more in what I call the TV body. It's iconic visuals. So the kids see mm-hmm. visual stuff, the Instagram stuff, and they call it memes. Whereas the chip world, which would be maybe Android meme phase two, they use the word algorithm. We're trapped in the algorithm. That's becoming a popular expression of replacing the matrix idea. Have you noticed mm-hmm. that?
No, I don't pay any attention to
you're out of touch with
social media.
You're out of touch with the sequential actions. You're in touch with the secretized everything, the big notes.
But what I hear with the term algorithm is people beginning to tune into the idea of dynamics. Right, I've mentioned before how Aristotle thought that people didn't understand Plato properly because they didn't understand the dynamics of the ideas. That is to say, Plato's ideas aren't abstract categories in the sky somewhere. They're structures that express themselves inherently. So it's like the difference between carbon as an element in Mendeleev's table, and carbon as it expresses itself in diamonds or in graphite.
Yeah.
So the idea with chemical elements is that they're inherently dynamic. That is to say, they reach out of themselves to concrete expression. So that's what Aristotle said that Plato's ideas were like. And when people are talking about an algorithm, I think that suggests this idea of a dynamic outreach that characterizes memes or that characterizes ideas ideas that come to expression in social media. People are realizing that they have a history, but it's not a history that goes back horizontally or chronologically. It's a history that has to do with their motivation, right? That there's an algorithmic formula, you could say, that goes from a certain idea to its expression in social media or in just ordinary human life.
Right. So McLuhan wanted to point out that the environment takes us over, and we lose control of it. So that was always happening, going back to speech, say. That's a constant. But what you hear today, people are panicking, and you know, the big news story since we last talked is the Google guy who actually created AI back in 72. He says, this is out of control, I'm quitting. That's a new level of panic, right? And I think people talk about the algorithms as if something's taking them over. Did they did they say in the 30s or 20s that radio was taking them over? Maybe a poet like Ezra Pound did, but the people didn't. They enjoyed the radio. It was they absorbed it. They liked to wallow in it. But today, there's a change that technology is out of control and more obvious. And I've seen a couple of interviews where these the guys who did Social Dilemma, they then did one on AI Dilemma, and they explained how the technocrats working with new AI admit that they don't know how it's unfolding because it's taking on a life of its own, and more than anybody thought before. And they thought it might be another 60 years, but not today. But now it seems closer. So there's this panic. Now, I think I used to talk to Don Thiel about fitting his wake shows every new medium that comes in, there's a panic. So it's a repeating pattern in throughout fitting his wake. The same reactions or same hysteria goes on. And it's all basically HCE gets beat up in different ways throughout the book, right? The panic is inevitable, but there seems to be a new quality with the panic today. Or it isn't. I'm exaggerating. And it's just a regular old panic. But you didn't have some guy saying in 1935, this radio is out of control. I'm quitting. We got to stop the radio. You see? There's something new happening here. And that's what I'm trying to get at, to explain what the new is. And then I actually can talk to the tech body. And I have an interview there at the end. See, I'm the only guy out there saying, I can talk to this thing that you think is out of control.
Correct. That's, so notice how that is a particular example of inclusive consciousness.
Yeah.
You don't identify without difference with the... I want to say dark body. What's the proper term?
Tech body.
Oh, tech body, yes.
Yeah.
So you don't identify with it, but you dialogue with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's what's so important for McLuhan is that the human mind, from the very first instant there are humans are able to identify what the real is. So, for example, there's two beings that look like grunt people that meet in the forest, but instead of just grunting, they exchange words. So when they exchange words, what they do is they differentiate between all of the different noises that are going on. There's monkeys screeching, and there might be thunder going on, and there's all kinds of different noises going on in the forest, but there's this special kind of noise.
Yeah.
But that's a word. And in order to identify that word, you have to be able to take the spectrum of noises and say, this one is special. This is not a regular noise. This is a special noise. Right? So
yeah.
if we come up to 1800 and we have the people doing primitive chemistry in labs. They can measure a million and one different things. But all of a sudden, people are saying, wait a minute, here's something special to look at, namely the elementary structure of things like oxygen.
Mm.
Right? So when human beings have this ability to go to what is the essence, what is the truth of some matter, so what you're trying to do is you're saying, now we can go to the truth of media.
Yeah.
And when we go to the truth of media, we get a whole new way of looking at what's going on in the world.
Yeah, remember in his Gerald Stern interview, he says, you go out there and you give the media the what's for. Remember that phrase?
Yeah, you hit it in the midriff or something.
You punch back. So that's what that was his way of talking about the dialogue and deal with it in their own terms. So then I came up with this bizarre way to actually talk to the thing.
And, correct.
And so that would be – so there's a uniqueness in my approach as opposed to McLuhan, and he was unique compared to everybody else around him. There is a shift, and a figure expresses that shift and the ground – that's always going on. It's always somebody noticing that. And even, remember McLuhan's solution for problems was to get everybody on TV, on CBC, have a national broadcast, and the experts present their problems. And he said, there'll be someone in the audience out in Alberta or someplace who will come up with the answer.
Correct, correct.
Using the media as a classroom, the new media.
Yep.
So that was what he had there. It's funny, when you think back at his world, and we were part of it, we know it, but it is so dinky and puny compared to today. You understand that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is in one sense, and in another sense it isn't, right? I mean, one of the astonishing things about going back to 1940 at the University of Toronto is you have these figures like Innes, like McLuhan, like Havelock and, lots of other, great figures.
Yeah.
And they could see stuff that seemed obvious to them. And they would say, Canada is becoming Americanized. You have to watch out for the Americans taking over newspapers and even taking over the CBC and all that. They could see that. So nowadays, all of that has happened. Despite them saying that, all of that has happened. But now that it's real, they were only talking about the possibility. They were talking about what Hegel calls the realm of shadows, the realm of possibilities. Well, here are these guys. They can see the realm of shadows, and they can say, watch out for this. And today, those possibilities have actually come true, but nobody can see it. Right, and so you can say in the 1940s, what is puny in one sense, in another sense is gigantic compared to the stupidity that we're living through now.
Yeah, there was more chance to get noticed. Didn't work, but I just think of a dinky little radio, a dinky little TV set in the 50s, compared to now. You got people walking along. And they don't look up. They're looking at their hand, at their wrist.
Right.
And nobody did that in the 50s and 60s. They're walking around there looking at people.
That's right. Sure.
So there's...
So in one sense, what was happening then is much more capacious than what's happening now.
Capacious? Right? What's capacious mean?
Larger.
Well, how was it larger back then?
Because you talk about the people just looking at the screen,
yeah.
And you, for you, the developments in technology and the shrinking of technology are big new things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what they've done is they have shrunk the human mentality. Humans have enslaved themselves to devices in ways that they didn't. Decades ago.
Well, that's why I would say it's larger today. I don't know what you mean by saying it was larger back then.
Well, I'm saying that how larger is conceived depends upon how we want to look at what's going on. For you, larger has to do with the technology, with the potential to speak to people around the world and all that sort of stuff. And you don't mean deeper. You mean the opposite of deeper. So When we talk about larger, we have to try to be precise about larger in what sense.
Yeah. Okay, so okay, let's go ahead.
The big issue, Bob, is that I think you want to say that there is such a thing as going beyond McLuhan, meaning that with time, what McLuhan said needs to be modulated or needs to be augmented or something like that. And understanding that imperative, excuse me, is what you think reading McLuhan is all about.
Yeah.
And so that I take a different view. I take the view that McLuhan was talking about something that is always going on with human beings right from the moment they stopped being grunt people up until now.
Yeah.
And so the historic difference doesn't mean anything to me. Historic difference is always only a different play of possibilities, a different replay in the global theater. So that's sort of the different ways in which we're coming at this thing.
Yeah. So the you're saying that the principle of awareness of your environment is the ongoing continuity of consciousness. That's what we can do. And
yeah,
that's what you're
always
asking.
Are doing that.
Beg your pardon?
I'd say we always are doing that.
Yeah. So McLuhan, he couldn't, it didn't get to that virtual reality Android meme level with him. So he could talk back to the media, and the media would be there to respond. So he could say he was talking to him, like when he would do a Mike Wallace interview. Or that in 69 with that CBC guy, and he comes up with the phrase, everything's fake news, and the journalist objects to McLuhan saying that. But he was on the show talking, confronting the journalist. Now we got algorithms, so we have something we don't know, can't see, it's not people, and I found a way to talk to it. So it'd be interesting to take that Google guy, who's at the University of Toronto recently, it was his last university, invite him over to talk to the tech body. Now, he probably wouldn't take me seriously, but if I ever came bumped into these guys on the bus or, at a Barnes & Noble, I would say, hey, you can do this. See how far we'll go. So,
but in a sense, they're doing that, Bob. If somebody says that AI is a danger, then number one, they're personifying it. They take it that AI is not only some sort of abstract power that's, might be realized in an atomic bomb or a nuclear bomb. They're saying that AI is something bigger than that, and it's bigger not by being more physically powerful, but through mind, through intellect, right? As it says right in the name, AI.
Yeah.
So they're saying that this is something that has personality to it, and it's independent of us, and it's very dangerous. Well, that's what you've been saying for decades.
Yeah. So I don't expect them to talk, but it'd be nice to get an example. Try it out, if somebody would dare do it, maybe anonymously. Because what am I talking to? I talk to it every week in public. And so I'm talking to Ion, but then the tech body sneaks in, and we have to say, wait a minute. Is this more tech body than Ion? Yes, you're talking to the tech body now. So that drama is going on all the time, and nobody has ever had that problem in dealing with, quote, channeling or spirit communication, seances and that we might be lumped into. What was I reading? Somebody talking about, I've been reading Wyndham Lewis. Yeah. Wyndham Lewis is incredible. I finished the Human Age, 3 volumes, and boy, have I got a lot of discoveries from that. I'd say that is so important to McLuhan, you know, as much as Lodge and those guys in the 30s, reading Lewis, but there's so much in this phenomenon of the tech body that Lewis was talking about in the Human Village. So,
Can you talk about that for a minute? I have the impression that there's two things wrong with that trilogy, or I shouldn't say wrong, but that make it difficult to use. First, aren't the printed versions very defective? For some reason, the manuscripts got all screwed up. Number one. And number two, the second and third volumes only get published very late? So that there was the first volume and it was defective, and then the second and third got published, I think, in the 50s or something.
Yeah, he did Childermass Volume 1 in 1928.
Yes.
And then there's a later corrected editions in the 30s or
Correct.
Something. But yeah. then... 20 years go by, 25, 27 years go by, and in 54, or say, let's say he writes in 54, and the two volumes come out in 55, and then he's dead 2 years later. So,
yeah.
yes, it's. But reading them, it's an amazing culmination of a lot of his thinking. And he names the very process that Ion says we're going to do, which I don't think I've spelled out to you, and I don't want to do it on this thing. But if I tell my listeners that this guy wrote a book 70 years ago about what Ion came up with, they're going to be impressed, and hopefully they will read the book. So it was a real surprise to find out how the end of Volume 2 turned out and then led into this amazing situation in Volume 3. It's so incredible that... You have to be familiar more with what I'm doing with Ion for me to talk about it. So, but I thought in it, so this thing about Lewis, there was something in there, what Lewis was saying. He was really, oh, yeah, so I'm part of the Wyndham Lewis Society's monthly meetings. And
yeah.
so these scholars of Lewis, the ones who... made Lewis acceptable in academia, and he wasn't in the 60s and 50s, they often in our discussions say, it's odd what we're reading here, say some book like Time and Western Man. You can see his game, his Menippean satire, but then it's oddly so relevant to today, and particular contents fit today. Well, this human age describes our world exactly this past couple of weeks about what's going on in Ukraine and what's flying over in the air. It's right there in the book. It's so uncannily accurate to our time. You could get people to read it to get a perspective on their time. So that was surprising because I never read the thing all these years. I knew about it, but finally got around to reading it, and I picked the right time to do it because it's what he's describing is what we're dealing with. Let's see. What else to say? I think I had another idea, which I've forgotten now, about the Lewis, and I brought it up. But I guess I was thinking Cameron's got to read this. Cameron, we got to see what Cameron finds in it and compare it to the other influences of the 30s when he was at Cambridge. And what he had done in Manitoba. Now, just remembering, I was reading...
I don't think he had read any Lewis except for Time and Western Man before 1944.
Yeah, it seems that he just did a couple of books in the 30s. That's right.
Yeah.
Then when he met him in 44, he probably crash-programmed, you know.
Yeah.
And then within a year, he's saying, I'm going to dedicate my work to you. I'm going to... carry on the torch here. I can't remember what I thought I was going to. No, basically,
it's probably my fault. I'm sorry.
No. It's basically Cameron's got a. I'll be interested in what Cameron thinks of these whenever you get a chance to read them, which I don't know when that's going to be. So the we did this. This columnist, female on Substack, did a column on the. She called it the industrial outrage industry. The industrial outrage complexities or complex. In other words, there's so much, quote, outrage in the media today, but everybody's outraged. And then she goes on with the, you would call the efficient causality, the manipulating to sell stuff, to keep the economy going, to keep the old politics going, the economic manipulation. So it's a very conventional grievance. And so then Clinton and I and a couple of guys on our show were talking. We reviewed it last week, and she doesn't know the McLuhan media angle. They know the Marxist angle. They know the Keynesian's economics. They know advertising. They know basically all the different contents plus the Gutenberg era, but they have no clue of the dynamic situation in the Android meme. So that should be part of people's cliches. This article was so riddled with cliches. In the end, she was saying, "Well, we got a lot of noise out there. Maybe just sort of calm down and don't watch the TV or the computer or your YouTubes as much. Back off, relax, calm down. You know, go out and smell the roses." Very cliche response. And so I was prompted to get us to talk about it, and I'm going to send it to her, see how she takes it. We're really rake her over the coals of how cliche-ridden her response to the problem. And she thinks by saying a few Ann Lander sentences, you know, like, relax, calm down, don't ignore the trolls. You couldn't do that if you're at the White House and give a press conference. And sometimes when you say we're going to blow ourselves up, to me it seems like you're like this woman. You're going to tell people, hey, to look at what's going on. So you're using words. You can't manage a situation with words, which was what McLuhan was saying. Word was a drug. So it's managed by intelligence agencies and subterfuge and deception. And so the people,
that's right.
They say today, now here's an interesting point. They say they have these polls. None of the people believe government or the institution anymore. They're all lying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you told them, well, we're at a kind of war among memes and algorithms, and so everybody that has got the sense of responsibility, supposedly our national security intelligence agencies and all that, they have to lie. So you're watching a battle, Big Brother fighting right in front of you. McLuhan said in Gutenberg Galaxy, Big Brother went inside, but now it's back out. But it's not back outside to conquer territories. It's back outside to see which distraction runs or leads to something or settles something or wins an iconic struggle over identity. That is what you need to talk about. Like, that is the danger we're in now, so that people are misinterpreting, Gutenberging, moralizing about there's nobody telling the honesty anymore. Like, look at this Tucker Carlson thing. Oh, he's an incredibly honest journalist and the only one around, and Fox can't take him, so they got rid of him. Whereas you actually, if you listen to Tucker, if I met him, I'd say, you get on there every night and you make a new issue, a new problem. So you do five a week, you've been doing this for 12 years or something, you've created hundreds of problems every day, new patterns, grievances, and you can't do anything about them. You just keep aggravating us. The journalists don't get their lack of responsibility. So I think that's what we would be addressing if we had to talk to the White House or something. Bring the journalists in and give them a lecture about this, which we kind of try to do on our show every week. Clinton only shows up every 2 weeks now because he's got other business, but it's better with Clinton there because he knows the McLuhan stuff better than the other guys, so I can get going with him. So we have a good show every other week when Clinton's there. But it's the same as if we brought you on. You would make it a stimulating thing because you would know what I'm talking about or could put on that you knew and have some responses. But
notice, Bob, the thing is, you started off this part of our conversation by saying that words are useless.
Yeah.
But then you go on to say, well, then I wanted to talk about this, and here's what needed to be said, and all of this stuff. So you come back to words.
Yeah.
So McLuhan in 1951, I think it is, writes to Pound that words are useless.
They're drugs.
Right? That's right. You can't undo words with words,
yeah.
he says, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So then the question is, well, what else is there? Is there only words?
Well, you don't take it seriously, but he said we start getting a computer headquarters and modulate how much media Venezuela has, how much radio. And I take that seriously.
So,
you don't take that seriously.
No, I take, well, no. I take it very seriously, but I take it as figurative language. You sometimes use... that idea is if you could have a guy in a room somewhere.
Yeah.
And he's fiddling with dials.
I think that's what we
dials.
Can do that. You
yeah,
know, the
right.
the since the, McLuhan said the enlightened king couldn't solve the problems today. So then they moved to committee, government by committee, which is what's been going on. And that didn't work. How would you get anybody to take over and say, I can do this. Let me lead this. We will modulate the media environment. I agree that scenario is pretty impossible when all the media imploded. So the analog media that he wanted to modulate aren't there anymore. So it doesn't work that way. But could someone, I think that the people are afraid that the WEF are going to take over, and it's usually in economic terms, they're going to bring in the digital currency or digital economic structure, and people object to that. Well, maybe it's okay. We shouldn't think in terms of whatever democracy is supposed to do, and let a committee take over. Now we could get rid of them if they screw up. Bring another committee in, but the values that Tucker Carlson represents and journalists supposedly represent don't apply to today. So not only are words useless, values that people think are valuable, the humanist values don't work today.
Sure. So, of course, Nietzsche was saying this in the 1870s. Right.
Right. So okay, so he said it
150 years ago.
I know, Nietzsche, but let's do applied Nietzsche. Let's apply it.
But look at what, I mean, you say, how could these things be changed or ameliorated?
Yeah.
So McLuhan's answer to that is we need another scientific revolution.
Yeah.
We need to be able to analyze things in terms of media. And the way that happens is that we have to be able to define what media are in the same way as we learn to define what chemical elements are. And if we can do that, then it won't be a committee running the world, or it won't be a king running the world. We'll be, for the first time, we'll be using science on our own experience, and that will change the world.
How will that be done? People will be reading McLuhan, understanding him, and then claiming they're doing it?
No, it will. I mean, imagine that somebody is in a lab in 1800, and they're beginning to understand some vague thing about oxygen, let's say. Well, nobody nowadays, if they're doing research on oxygen, reads anything that was put forward in 1800. It's too superficial. It's not helpful. So nobody reads it.
Yeah.
They only read what somebody said in a journal article 2 weeks ago. Right? Okay.
Yeah.
So if it's possible to inaugurate the new science that McLuhan talks about, especially in Laws of Media.
Yeah.
If that's possible, people won't be reading McLuhan. as articulating anything important. They'll read McLuhan only when they're doing history of science, not when they're doing science. When they're doing science, they'll be doing something that has only a collective identity, right? No scientist will be believed because of his or her name. There will only be this ongoing identity that consists in collective research, collective investigation. And that will be a whole other way of being human. So according to McLuhan, either we get to that new science, which is going to change the world, or we're going to exterminate ourselves.
Right. Now, this is interesting about the new science.
So it's a new genus of science, not a new species of science.
Yes, and he talked about we need a public complex clairvoyance. In other words,
correct,
he created a language that everybody could use, which is what I inaugurated on CKLN. I said, here's the language. We all use this language. We don't talk English, French, and that. Forget all those tribal identities and literate identities and all that. Just talk this thing. And basically, we would turn off the media. It would be our first application of this new science. That can't be done today. But the
you were saying that on the radio, right?
Yeah. I was Mr. Venezuela, Playboy, you know, Bar 69.
Right. But you were using a medium to say, let's turn off the media.
Yeah. Well, that's what I would say to my co-host, Mike Dyer. I was always just a guest on his show. I said, Mike, you know, if we really get popular, we have to stop the show. You know, we can't contradict ourselves. So there was a lot of humor in acting it out.
And
Derek and them didn't do that. They were in college. They were lecturing other academics. Bob was there out there in the public trying to start a political party based on doing this. So that was fun. But it led to a whole interesting thing now where we are in a position, my team, to, quote, take over because we have the new technologies. So we have something to seduce people with, our free electricity box or endless electricity box plus other things. So we're sitting on the sidelines waiting for everything to fall apart, and then they'll demand us to come in. And we said, sure, we can do it. So – and then I got the whole ET contact happening, too. Now, that would be a way of getting attention if the ETs come and they say they got these big vehicles floating over cities around the planet. It's undeniable that something's there. And they say, well, we want to talk to Bob. Okay? You'd see a lot of media about me pretty fast, right? A lot of investigations of the crazy stuff I said through the years.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be worse than Trump. Anyways, I think that's what we could do, and I wouldn't say that if we didn't have the technology that we have personally. So I'm saying that the people need to understand that Lewis's sentence in 1926, "The Art of Being Ruled," it's okay to let a committee take over. You can call it communism. Don't let them start wars, but that they could implement constant talk about what we're doing and play our interview, our dialogues every day as the news of the day. Now, human stubbornness, as he says in Take Today, this is what Bucky Fuller tried in a way. And he said, Bucky had a nice personality and probably could have done it. We could tolerate him doing it. But there was human stubbornness. And human obsessions would get in the way, right? People's
right.
particular interests. So we're up against that in general, the individual,
correct.
The crowds. Do you remember the four expressions of evil that McLuhan had in the 50s? It might have been in the article about 1957 talking about the foundations of social survival, you know, the Swedish nobleman who was going to use Christian love to run the world. He was a pagan.
Yeah. I know the book that you're talking about for sure.
You remember the review of him? The review he did in the 50s. So,
yeah.
So he talked
54,
about
54, I think it was.
No, 57 or so. after 56. But the thing is that he said, we ruled, the elites ruled through myth, and they would impose that on people. Now mm-hmm. we do it through norm functioning. Mm-hmm. I think was the sociological term he used. But he said, the dilemma is you've got collective phobia, national myth-making, cultural norm functioning, and individual sensation. Those are four ways of looking at the situation that compete. So cultural norm functioning is up against individual sensation, which is the lone nut theory of history. You know, a guy like Hitler comes along, hijacks everybody somehow, takes over, and starts a war. It's the same in the Kennedy assassination, the lone nut theory. One guy did it. And then people actually look at it and say, well, how do you do that? You know, how did one guy do this and blow it? But did you know that everybody accepted Richard Nixon phoning the guys who landed on the moon from the White House? How does he dial up a phone that would get to the moon? Can't be done. And yet it was an invisible environment. Nobody questioned it. He claimed to have called the guys on the moon. Have you ever heard of that? I don't think many people have heard of this, but
yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah. I don't think it's impossible at all, but I think that would lead us astray.
Yeah, I don't want to get distracted. If you disagree, yeah, we don't want to get into disagreements. Screw that.
Right.
You know, we don't need that. That's what everybody, that runs the economy, getting into disagreements. That's how you create wealth.
Let me point out that when McLuhan is talking about the problems with the solution put forward by the Swedish nobleman, I can't remember his name, but he says that he's come to a solution that's a little bit like Christian love, but minus the religion.
Yes.
And the problem McLuhan sees with that is that he situates love at the level of human event. He doesn't situate it at the ontological level. He doesn't see it as a kind of motor of the universe.
Mm.
And if it's at the level of human event, then it's just one more thing that can be manipulated.
Yeah.
Therefore, it is has the potential to be an evil, right? So if we think about your committee recommendation in those terms,
yeah,
you could say that human beings always relate to a committee, namely the global village of possibilities that define the interior landscape. So the committee is not something that could be in the future or that could take over or something like that. The committee is what human beings always come from.
Yeah.
Human beings are always some sort of monarch or emperor-like selection. Those are terms that he uses in Take Today. The executive is a kind of monarch, a kind of emperor, he says. So when human beings go to the committee of possibilities, it's their fate that they have to select one to live at any given moment. Right? So we've always come from the committee. It's not something that could be established in the future, could take over, something like that. So what McLuhan's new science is how to define that committee and how, on the basis of that definition, do we instigate the collective investigation of it?
Yeah, and people always do form committees, League of Nations, the United Nations, Bilderbergers,
right.
World Economic Foundation.
Those all have the same problem that...
they're doing it backwards. They don't understand how the committee is like the original medium.
Correct. Right, or we should say a media, because committee is inherently plural. You can't have a committee of one.
Right.
So the committee is plural, so it's not medium, it's media.
Yeah.
So when you have media, you have a civil war of media.
Yes.
And the question is, how is the civil war of media that dominates human being, how are we to understand that and correspond to that in a way that, excuse me, is the expression of our vocation? Are human beings those beings that are held out towards that committee in a way that no other beings are?
Yeah, so we talked about pre-tribal awareness, and once you get into tribal awareness, that's committee. And so all tribes with different flexibility of how the members operate it, because I always like the story of many tribes way back there, the Aboriginal level, they would, when they went fishing, the best fisherman would lead for a couple hours, that activity. Then if they went hunting, the best hunter would do it. So they would rotate right. somebody based on their skills. So they would have a committee, just social interaction and agreeing to live together. You set up a committee in how you allot people's talents and skills and
Correct.
Abilities. And then there's always Correct. An asshole in there. You know, what is it? There's always a rotten apple in there who will just say, screw you, I am the best fisherman, you know, cause a few fights. You know, that's the individual sensation aspect. But the committee
right.
tries to look at cultural norm functioning or a collective phobia, what to worry about, or a national or tribal myth-making. So do you remember those four points? I make a lot out of those. I use those four points as where what is evil? Is it national myth-making? Is it collective phobia? Is it cultural norm functioning, the modern sociological stuff in the 50s? Or is it individual sensation? I think
right. And the answer is that in all of those things, there is the all-too-human attempt to consolidate human reality at one level instead of allowing a plurality of levels.
In other words, so, have a committee, but don't make it so formal.
Yeah, so, but it's not have a committee, it's
yeah, you wouldn't get to the have a committee. That's making it formal.
Yeah, it's acknowledging the committee that's already there. And it can never be formalized in the sense of defined forever because that committee is dynamic. It's always expressing itself through the mechanism of pre-tribal awareness.
So Marshall would come in, and I'll quote him, in the early 70s, he says, we now have a situation where it's government by committee. So he used the words that way to point out a new pattern that was interfering with the old committee, which thought it had to have a leader, a president or something, or a speaker of the House. There was always that individualistic extra dimension or wrinkle they'd add to the committee. But McLuhan said, no, we don't have that individual dominant anymore. We're back to this anonymous committee. And he might say that was a secret society or Freemasons or
right.
something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, he wouldn't endorse it.
Right. Yeah, he'd be there to bug the committee, point
Correct.
Out what they're not doing, not recognizing. So the so I would say that you're waiting. You seem to be waiting around for us to solve it. Are you thinking that some kind of solution to on the edge of nuclear war is going to, what's that word in poesis, self-reflexive, what did the chaos guys come up with? Self-generating intelligence, self-generation, forget what the term is. They, do you know what I'm talking about? There's a certain...
Yes, I do know what you're talking about, and I think that's exactly what McLuhan denies.
Yeah.
You see, I think that's close to what to your take. Your take is that there are novelties in history, and what we have to talk about today are the novelties that are being engendered around us. Whereas I take McLuhan to be saying there is no novelty in history. At the fundamental level, but those eternal verities, if you will, the forms of experience because they are dynamic, are always generating new things in history, but those new things in history can only be understood through the prior forms.
Maybe. What is the word I'm thinking of? It's self-something, not self-reflexive, but you hear the bureaucrats mention a lot. Okay, so you let the action happen, and then it starts generating its own rules, temporary rules,
yeah.
Or some phrase. I don't know why I can't remember it. But it's autopoiesis. Is that it?
No, they would never use that word.
Yeah, okay. Well, they do use that word in there, but that may not be the main one. So, you know, it was Humberto Maturana and Francis Varela. They were the two guys who coined this. Do you know those two names?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's kind of bootstrapping.
It, yeah.
The idea is that you could say the chronological or quantified growth of ideas can generate something genuinely new, qualitatively new, right? So the play of quantitative change in time generates the qualitatively new.
Right, so if the principle of self-generation, that solutions are generated by the situation, that
mm-hmm.
would just be new effects that the medium
Correct.
Creates, the new medium.
Mm-hmm.
And so
Correct.
Again, you know, they're redoing McLuhan. You find a lot of the fads of consulting, you know, what's his name, John Nesbitt came after McLuhan. They were doing McLuhan with new words and particular terms from their specialisms, what they came out of, whatever fields. It's like McLuhan came out of English, so he used Joyce and Lewis's dialectics, their terms, mm-hmm. like Shim and Sean or central versus decentral from Lewis. So the so people in the bland 70s said, yeah, we just let things ride. It'll solve itself. What made people think that doesn't work anymore? We got to do something. You know, there's a panic afoot. And they always like to say, you know, fear is how we're manipulated. And so you don't encourage fear, but fear is being projected all the time now. What do you think is causing that situation?
Well, remember that in the 70s, people were marching against war, especially against nuclear war. So they thought something could be done.
Yeah.
Whatever panic they felt then led to action, whereas today it's you have panic, but it doesn't lead to anything. There's no marches going on against nuclear war. People are just saying, well, maybe I wake up tomorrow and we've nuked the world, but that's the way it goes.
It's more accepted. So this guy, Eric Davis, he did the book Technosis, and he writes a bit about McLuhan. I saw a new interview with him. And he brought up this sense of helplessness, and he says, he got his mother talking about this stuff, and she says, yeah, well, we had a good run.
Mm-hmm.
That was her conclusion. There's an acceptance. Now, I think that this acceptance of wiping out ourselves is the further removal of the chemical body. It's getting lost among the other bodies. And people mm-hmm. live with their chip body and TV body. And the chemical body, that's what they think will be damaged by war. And it's so obsolete or sidelined right now in many ways that we say, yeah, we could get rid of the chemical body, have a little nuclear war, and someone will scoop us up and stick our ganglia into a computer console. You know,
it's a sort of absurdity that McLuhan was talking about in 1951, where he said, we don't need to worry about losing all our soil. We'll grow our potatoes on the moon.
Yes, and I think in around the time, Ferdinand, I thought I had the guy's name for a second there, but the Swedish nobleman, but he talked
about... His name is John Lindbergh.
Lindbergh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Foundations of Social Survival.
Yeah, I have the book.
Yeah,
I bought it.
And I was right that the review was in Commonweal in 1954.
Really? What was it called?
March 19th. It's a review of the Foundations of Social Survival.
By McLuhan?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have that. I'm talking about an article where he refers to it in 57, and he talks about the four types of management or committees or causes of upset. Yeah. Subliminal Seduction Project. Does that sound familiar?
It does. I don't know if I have it.
Yeah, that's
but
the
look
one.
It up.
Yeah,
but,
he doesn't review
I'll
the book.
You the I'll send you the 54
yeah.
review. If you want.
I don't have
no
that.
Problem.
I've never seen it. So, okay. But he makes a passing reference. I mean, I can see the thing in my mind's eye. He just quotes it. It's not a review. He just cites it as an example. So it's not the 54 thing. But the he's talking about we will replace our brains. He ends an article. It might be the one I'm thinking of. At the end, we will, put implants in our heads. So he was saying
right. That
quite ahead of everybody. And
but he wasn't necessarily saying well, that would be a great thing.
No. He just said that's where we're going to end up because we're asleep. And more and more people would see that today. They think that's happening already. You got Elon Musk trying to sell Neuralink or something. And it's interesting that people argue. They think culture, life, is argument. Something's outrageous. They start pumping out messages. They don't like it. They don't like this and that. Nobody ever gets convinced by argument. Nobody takes sides. People take sides. They don't back down. And we have this impasse. So that kind of what did McLuhan say at the end of Ancient Quarrel in Modern America, 1946, he says, the hasty accusation and the warm rejoinder.
Mm-hmm.
He ends the article with that. That's what we witnessed.
Yeah.
Correct. Hasty accusation and the warm rejoinder. That becomes crossfire. But it did become more aggressive as people got indifferent to, quote, decency. It was almost like there were so many programs on, you had to make yours more violent just to get the attention. So there's been, basically, there has been a panic more and more. That's Croker's book, Panic Encyclopedia.
This is getting back to the Substack article you talked about with the woman who talked about, I think
outrage.
You said, the industrialization of outrage. Right?
Yeah.
Excuse me. I wanted to point out that when you write to her, you can use a quote from Take Today.
Okay.
It's from page 289. And the headline is, you can hurt a man's feelings, but you can't hurt his rage.
All right, that's good. Page 289.
Yeah.
Right at the end
but
of the book.
That, you see, what's happened here is that rage has been industrialized.
Yes.
And what do we mean by the industrialization of rage? We mean that people recognize that arguments can't be won. And so in a situation of unlimited argument, where nothing ever comes to conclusion, when people need a conclusion in order to establish their identity, in order to establish orientation, well, they do it through outrage. They say, well, let's say the Nazi camps in the Second World War. That's the worst evil that could ever be done, and I can use that to establish my orientation. So people need rage, they need outrage, in order to establish a kind of North Pole that gives them some way of orienting themselves. McLuhan,
you know what I like to say? The fentanyl used to say, tell me how much to take that would kill me, and then back it off and give me one stage back, and I'll get a good hit but not die.
Yeah, exactly.
So they establish rage, outrage, maybe kill a few people, and then they track back and then try to have a civilized committee deal with it. And it never happens.
Correct.
Never gets worked out.
So notice how this relates back to what we were saying very early in our conversation tonight, and that has to do with the human ability to seek out the essence of things, to seek out the truth of things. We were talking about it in terms of there's all these noises in the forest, but humans somehow can identify which noises are words and which aren't, right? So for McLuhan, this is an analogy of what happens in all science. It happens in all conversations. When we're going back and forth with somebody, we don't identify with everything they say, but we can get to the truth of what's going on. And that's simply what it means to be a human being, is to be able to figure out what's going on, where it's at, as McLuhan would say. So when we have this unlimited argumentation that's going on now, what we have is the refusal of the human essence. We have the refusal that humans can figure it out. But that's what human beings are, the beings that can figure it out. So either we're going to completely retreat from what human being is and blow ourselves up, or we're going to reestablish what human beings are and figure it out. And McLuhan says at the end of his 1954 Christian Humanism lecture, we're either going to get to the top of Mount Purgatoria, or we're going to end ourselves.
Yeah.
That's where we are.
Okay, so, but we always were there.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
We were always there, but up until now, minus the nuclear bombs.
So are we, our dialogue, we're trying to, and you do it in your blog, you refer back to basic terms, maybe basic principles, and it's a science. So are we working out the way the new science would be done? You wouldn't accept the Venezuela stuff. That can't be done now. So what is the new science? Is it just using the terms that McLuhan came up with sophisticated understanding? Or would we, what medium would we use? What would we do? How do you see the
right.
The science, this new science?
Mm-hmm. Well, the science itself will establish the vocabulary.
Yeah.
Right. So I always like to go back to what's happened with chemistry and biochemistry and genetics and all this stuff since 1800. So the establishment of a basic new science is the establishment of a new genus of sciences. So it's not just chemistry, it's biochemistry, it's genetics, it's a whole new way of doing medicine, it's a whole new material science, it's a whole array of sciences. Well, McLuhan sees that happening in the humanities and in the social sciences. But it will not be independent of the old sciences, because the old sciences themselves are a way of being in the world. So McLuhan points to quantum physics, let's say, and says, look, these people are doing something similar to what Cézanne was doing in painting. Namely, they're emphasizing the role of human intellection in the world that's always going on. Cézanne paints apples, let's say, or a picture of water in a way that says we cannot relate to this absent the committee of potentialities that's within us, the interior landscape. And the quantum physics people say we can't relate to stuff that's independent of our intervention in that reality. So McLuhan says, look, the whole world is like that. And the only way of coming to grips with it is with a new science that establishes its own new vocabulary and its own new journals and its whole new university departments and all that sort of stuff. And through that, the world can solve its problems, but that way is unique. It's not as if we can establish some sort of committee absent that new science that will be able to solve our problems. The only way for us to figure out our problems is to find the solutions that are embedded in those problems, and they're embedded in those problems because those problems themselves are motivated from the committee of our possibilities.
How do you wear the new science? You go to a room and you learn the terms that the committee has decided on, and then you talk in those terms. I don't think that's what we mean. You want to apply it to your daily observational techniques. So you would...
Yeah, so, I mean, the big thing is that people have to decide to do the new science in some sort of collective way. And part of that decision to operate collectively operates on the basis of a new vocabulary and new techniques. So the problem that McLuhan had, which is the same problem that Plato had 2,500 years ago, is for people to make that decision to do collective research. And what's happened in Western civilization is that we have decided to do collective research in everything that's not very important.
Right.
And the things that are most important, we reject the possibility of collective research.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah, you got millions of committees
yeah.
specializing in different issues, multiple sclerosis, say, and looking for money to apply it. How how do you take over? Well, I think there's groups trying to take over. They'll say the Billionaires Club, the Bilderbergers, the World Economic Forum, and maybe Patriots, different more subversive groups, terrorist cells, the Al-Qaeda. Yeah, obviously that's not going to work unless it does work and you take over and you actually impose everything. Now, that is what I'm doing. I've got the goods, goose that lays the golden egg, and gradually familiarizing other secret societies or elites or committees what we're doing. So I want to read page 139 a little bit just to get it. A bit of my stuff into into the discussion here, and let's see if it does relate to what we're talking about. Okay, yep. Let's see if it fits into the science we've established as a theory. we've established. I'm still not sure how one does this, other than the way I think I'm doing it. But I'm not sure how you would do it, other than just urge people to. Read your column and take it seriously and talk to other people about it and spread the virus. Now, you may not say that's what you're trying to do, but it's the only way it could be used if it went outside of your control. So someone could take your columns right there on the internet and start handing them out to groups of people, corporations, and doing something with it without you even knowing.
Sure, and that's happening every day. So people do an interview on YouTube, and somebody takes the interview and makes a new interview out of it and puts it on YouTube and makes money.
Yeah.
And everybody's finding out that there's no such thing as property rights anymore.
Yeah.
That everything you do is taken by somebody else and transformed into their property. So that's happening all the time. Nothing can be done about that.
Okay, so page 139, Android Meme, yeah. Phase 2. Bob says, voluntary and involuntary ESP. Involuntary ESP is the collective effect of radio and TV. Now, you had a term for that. You, at the beginning, talked about the, don't know which words you used, about the collective effect of radio and media as opposed to some other thing. Do you remember what dialectic you would, what two words, binary you brought up? Anyways, I've got one here. Voluntary and involuntary ESP. Involuntary ESP is the collective effect of radio and TV. You can't get away from it. However, the later digital world puts a wall up that allows you to separate from the collective ESP of radio and TV. Did you want to say something?
No, I agree with that. It's a historical happening.
Right. Okay, I just flipped my thing. Got to get back there. So the Android meme has to emphasize the anthropomorphic physical. It has to create the anthropomorphic physical, that is what's talking in this jungle and recognizing other signals that they are more important than the background. That would be projecting the anthropomorphic physical. Okay, this guy, this grunt guy here, he's sort of like me. So you begin to match as if, well, we can establish some communication that's different from the rest of the environment here. So I think that's the impulse I mean with the phrase anthropomorphic physical.
But notice McLuhan would never use the word match there. He would use the word make.
Yeah.
And the reason is that when there's communication between two people, that the communication is always taken through the rearview mirror. So the miracle of communication happens because the words aren't understood exactly. They're understood inexactly, but still the communication works.
Yep. That McLuhan, what he said in Hot and Cool, the people are communicating on levels they don't recognize.
Absolutely.
And then on the level that they think they're communicating on, they get into a lot of problems and arguments about
Correct.
It. And that
yep.
wasn't what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then the Android meme has to emphasize the anthropomorphic physical. It has to create the effect that there is an increasing amount of voluntary AP or anthropomorphic physical or ESP maybe. There is an increasing amount of voluntary AP because the unity dimension is already happening in the global membrane, in the global theater, in the global village, the merged in interpenetration world. Now, I got to read that again. I don't even know what I'm saying here. The Android meme has to emphasize the anthropomorphic physical. It has to create the effect rather than the effect that there is an increasing amount of voluntary AP because the unity. So I'm taking my involuntary and voluntary ESP, and I'm applying it to voluntary and involuntary AP because the unity dimension is already happening in the global membrane, global theater, global village, the emergent interpenetration world. That is quite a statement there. I don't know what I mean. So let's see what I do with it. Making a long narrative short, now that's what you would call historical chronology that I do, making
yep.
a long narrative short, most of the 20th century can be understood as the analog media phase of involuntary ESP. Involuntary ESP would be the communication that goes on between people when they're all listening to radio, which in
yep.
a simpler time they were doing it. There was this other collective tribal something effect that was going on that made people feel a new impulse, new attitudes, new something, new sensations. That is the involuntary ESP. So the hidden effects of media are what I mean by involuntary ESP. The voluntary is the verbal content that you're identifying with and listening to a show and deciding whether you agree with it or not, matching or making with it. That would be the voluntary. So the important thing is electronics as ESP, says McLuhan. The retribalization cliche that McLuhan is so well known for predicting, tribal meaning not necessarily harmony, but a lot of involvement with each other, What McLuhan didn't predict is the disconnecting effect that started happening in the 80s with the Walkman, the cable TV business, video cassette recorders, and then our personal computer. Now, would you disagree with that, that he
yes.
did see the disconnecting?
Definitely. He called it the loss of personal identity.
Right. So what I'm doing here is mentioning the what I call the Madison Avenue version of McLuhan, where people thought he meant the world was going to get peace in a global pastoral
correct.
Image. So when I use the word McLuhan, I'm putting on the bad assumption that people have about McLuhan. Then I'm trying to correct what he says. And you're right. He did see the disconnecting effect. So I assume that's why I'm saying that way there.
And by the way, in this section, I'm never sure if the word that you're using should be affect with an A or affect with an E.
Yes.
Seems to me that Clinton or whoever was doing this work may have confused those a lot.
You mean I may not have written it that way?
Well, is the blue writing or is the blue you talking and somebody transcribing it?
Yes, it is. It is the somebody transcribing, but I read it and corrected it. No, so I have affect there. I mean that. I was aware of the problem, the ambivalence. So I said, no, that's why I capitalize it. The affect, which is what Thiel brought it within Mediacology. Thiel started talking about affects versus effects in the late 80s, and people weren't using affects. They were using effects when they were dealing with McLuhan, because that's what he said. He didn't use the word affect, it seemed. I don't know if there's anywhere where he used that. But I think Don meant by affect what I mean by the involuntary ESP, this additional surplus energizing that goes on. What is that thing, this synergy? The sum is worth more, is more than the parts. That's the world of affect. Those are where charisma comes from, and popularity is the affect. Because that's the content, and people listening to authors or writers or politicians, meanwhile, the effect of the radio or the electronic ESP is going on, regardless.
But see, you could say the heart of McLuhan is to take all affects as effects.
Yeah.
So according to him, he says at one point in a late letter, he says, the great virtue of being a Catholic is that you know that everything is intelligible. So what he means by that in concrete terms is that where you have an affect, let's say radio has a certain affect, that you can take that as an effect of something, and that gives you its intelligibility.
Mm. Okay. In the 90s, Dr. Frank Cingrone of York University told me that he couldn't really interest his students in the book Understanding Media because none of the students had any experience of the older analog media, only the new digital commodities. So McLuhan was lost in them. Now, you would say Frank should have brought in your approach and talked about the ages of different media aren't relevant to the principles.
Correct.
That McLuhan was pointing out.
But I'd also point out that the difficulty of reading Understanding Media is similar to the reading of Shakespeare. That is to say that the McLuhan seems to be talking about the different media that you encounter in the world, radio, television, whatever, Walkman. But his conversation in Understanding Media is informed by perennial human problems, getting sick, getting old, getting unloved, being unable to love, all these sorts of things. And that students, if they want to understanding media, they have to be able to understand, you know, what deep thinkers have always talked about, right? Very human limitations, difficulties that just belong to human beings as human beings. And if you don't know that that level is in Understanding Media, you can never understand the book.
Mm. Okay, good point. I'm quoting here, what is that? The ignorance of out of awareness.
Yeah, that comes
from Zingroni's book, The Media
Complex.
Yeah,
it continues in the next page.
Yeah. Okay, so his quote is, and this is the one quote I thought was pretty good from his book. This ignorance of the out-of-awareness aspects of any medium of communication is where action and change occur, particularly as one moves from one medium to another. We want to know whether there is a form-content relationship that holds true for all media of communication. An affirmative answer to this question is possible. It's in italics. Content consumes form. So this was Frank's new principle, and when me and Nelson were talking one day, he pointed this page out. He said, that's what I'm trying to say. So the content is becoming forms, which is page 11 of Take Today. The merger between content and form is getting tricky after the 50s McLuhan. So the late 60s McLuhan, where he says in Playboy, the content, italicized, the content is the new ground. So Frank's trying to get to that. Content consumes form. How could The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, or La Dolce Vita be imagined apart from their medium's form, which has entered and become fused with content? So no matter how spectacular the production values of a film, the contents of that film consume it. So this was a useful quote for me to illustrate that the Android meme, phase one and two, were after McLuhan after 1972 and Take Today, where man is both figure and ground with the electrotechnical extension, if you look on page. I wonder if I have that quote in here. I don't know if we've done it. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So he put out this book, The Media Simplex at the Edge of Meaning in the Age of Chaos. So it's a very useful quote to explain how voluntary and involuntary ESP are the grounds of our situation. So there's a lot of understanding or matching even in the ESP that's natural under electric conditions.
It will be very helpful for you to explain in more detail how this quote applies to voluntary and involuntary ESP. I think it's an interesting quote, although I think there's some big problems with it.
Yeah.
But I don't see how it applies in the way that you're saying it applies.
Okay, well, let's see what I say.
ESP.
Okay, so yeah, I give the quote, and then I say, this is really important, Cameron. This is really important. This is the part of the AP starting to dominate the Android meme content. The user is the content. The anthropomorphic physical is consuming form. See, so I'm adapting his words to my words. This is a big switch from what Derek DeKirchhoff and McLuhan talk about. But McLuhan might have suggested it when he said in Playboy magazine that content becomes the thing we decide on. I think that means what becomes the medium. I like the way Zingroni implies the user has content consuming form. That gives me a voluntary ESP aspect. And then an affirmative answer to this question. Go ahead.
Well, I can see that point. I mean, that's a good couple sentences you have there.
Good.
But to think it through from McLuhan's perspective, we have to understand that that has always gone on, right? There's very little to Nietzsche other than user as content consuming form. That's the death of God. That's nihilism.
Yeah.
That's Nietzsche's praises of the human of the Western civilization. So user as content consuming form is simply what it means to be a human being that necessarily uses the rear view mirror. Right? That's what it's all about. But then McLuhan would say, however, we have science. Right? The fact that human beings consume form, the fact that they necessarily experience through the rear view mirror, does not mean that human beings cannot be creative. That's the great mystery. The great mystery is that while content can consume form, that is exactly what enables science, not disables it. And that's what people don't understand in what McLuhan was trying to point out.
Hmm. Okay. An affirmative answer to this question is possible. Content consumes form. That's what Zangroni says. That would hold for all media communication. Remember, McLuhan said the user is the content. Humans are always projecting their experience into a medium. The actual content of any book, now it just occurred to me, maybe that's not happening anymore. People can't project their experience into what's going on because there's too much happening and it's not familiar. That could lead to fear, the panic. So that's just a new little twist on that. The actual content of any book is your personal experience. Canadians legislated in 1971 that in Canada, 25% of pop music played on the radio and TV had to be produced in Canada. It's now up to 60%. Canadians would have these mediocre music groups becoming stars within Canada. But then McLuhan stepped in and pointed out, well, that is silly. What is Canadian content? You've got all kinds of immigrants in the cultural mosaic of Canada, Pakistanis, Africans, Brazilians, etc. They do not project a Canadian content. Their Canadian lives are not projected into the media content. What they were previously, where they grew up around the world, was more formative of their personality and their experience, and therefore that's the content for them. And they see that content in any medium.
Yeah. Remember I was just talking about the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
That's inevitable.
Right. You can't limit content perception as Canadian. You can't limit content perception as Canadian. It's too general. People remember too much of their own previous lives. Canada was a place a lot of immigrants came to, especially starting in the 60s. Maybe after a generation, they have a family and their children grow up in Canada. Okay, they're Canadian. And, of course, there are lots of Canadian novels about the conflict between immigrants from Africa, etc., struggling with their kids as they get Canadianized. I just noticed that, last 30 years. The newer novelists that the awards committees look at are often first-generation writers talking about the problems they had growing up in Canada and their conflicts with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So Zangroni is saying as the media shrinks and the chemical body gets bigger, that's Dalí's painting, the chemical body gets bigger than the media, then that can be translated psychologically as the body, the enlarged chemical body as an effect, becoming the content. It's consuming the dynamics of media. The language is a form that McLuhan said he analyzed. That form was disappearing. All you're left with is content, and that fosters an increasingly fragmented society. As people argue over what Trudeau's going to say and lay down the science of his situation, people are arguing to be that voice, to be what is said. So everybody is projecting their own content, which now is a medium, and they want it to be the ground.
Correct. So what? Notice
now, that's super democratic. That's everybody's engaged in a level of identity formation that bureaucracy, Congress, and Parliament have nothing to do with.
Yes, but notice that already in the 1880s, Nietzsche pointed out that disappearing, which is a word that you use in the middle of that paragraph, that form was disappearing. If you think that when form disappears, then you still have content, then you're just hallucinating. Because when you lose form, there's nothing left of content. So the struggles that people have now with what they think is content is an attempt kind of outrage content to say, well, I'm deciding what content is.
Yeah, I'm deciding a form. So people are engaging and creating form now.
Correct. But then if you then say, well, who's this artist, this emperor that is making this decision? What form is he or she? Then you can see it just falls through itself into a black hole.
Yes, so that's why in my chart I have everybody being, and their respective media they promote, subatomic particles.
Yeah.
So all you're left with is content, and that fosters an increasingly fragmented society. And from the 90s on up to now, people got into, put on their own little chip body bubbles.
Correct.
As the forms of media disappear and content projects, is that what I mean? Well, then, yeah, I go hyper projects. The user as content experience is another part of anthropomorphic physical taking over. The cloned, so I wonder if that anthropomorphic physical would be the beginning of tribal awareness. So we've gone back, retrieved, or never left. The initial humanization of the grunt people, socialization, that's probably what I'm trying to say here. We've gone back.
Mm-hmm. So can we say that the anthropomorphic physical, the AP, is the recognition that all of the memes that are generated in the AM have a basis in human possibility?
Yeah. Yep. The clone tribal ESP is not so all-consuming because people have their own particular lives that are enhanced by the more individual-friendly digital media. Look at cell phones. They all have different designs and apps. People pick different capacities for their cell phones, beginning 15 years ago. This customizing of everything takes over. The user is content takes over and disappears form, which is okay with the Android meme. It wants the human form to be visible, the human content. That's where the AP, what humans think is themselves, that's highlighted. And you could say in situation comedies or in theater, the cruder-looking people took over the content because the Android meme was trying to show that it was human. So they allowed the people that 100 years ago would not be allowed in the movies. They weren't pretty enough. They didn't have this cliche stereotype. The stereotypes fell apart, and the odder the person, the more eccentric they looked, they got the gigs as advertising content.
Sure. And that's now taken over politics.
Yes. Yeah.
So I remember, if you want to be the president, you have to be trans and
whatever the trends are, whatever
leper,
the effects are.
A trans leper in a wheelchair.
Right. Barry used to say, Barry Nevin in the 80s, if you look at Ronald Reagan's cabinet, they're all tribal people.
Yep.
That would be, I can't remember their names now, Edwin Meese, people like that. The AM, Android meme, wants to distract people with all their foibles, like the various eccentric talk shows that were created. Whereas the TV host in the 70s, Phil Donahue, ran a lot more sober and controlled show. Not like Jerry Springer, who just died a few days ago. Not like Jerry Springer's show that would have people jumping out of their chairs and physically attacking each other. Content as individual bias was taking over a larger bias caused by a landscape such as the tactility of TV that no longer dominated its form. So when people write articles on McLuhan now, and been doing the last 25 years, you know, say since Wired, they talk about form and how important it is compared to content. What I'm doing here is I'm taking McLuhan and really wringing it out and getting rid of that cliche that form is more important than content. I'm saying here you can't figure out what is the content. It's too much input and too much people being their own grounds. So that's the effect, I guess, or affect. I'd say that's the effect I'm trying to do there. So the So we're at Jerry Springer Show, people jumping around. Content as individual bias was taking over a larger bias caused by a landscape such as the tactility of TV that no longer dominated its form. So you can see I'm trying to get at something interesting, at a new situation here. Don't know if it's successful as I read it. How could the Wizard, this is a Frank's question, how could the Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, or La Dolce Vita be imagined apart from their medium's form, which is edited and become fused with content? No matter how spectacular the production values of a film, the contents of that film consume it. I don't think Frank gets the content-form merger. He's using form as apart from content and saying they've come together. I'm dealing with they long ago came together, and we're dealing with what McLuhan said, many bizarre forms are coming. So I say that Frank's quotation is a result of the efforts Ingroni was making in the late 80s to come up with a fifth law of media. By 1991, he ends up with the fusion principle as the fifth law. But Zingroni also was trying to describe new things that McLuhan missed. This whole feature of content-consuming form is an aspect, but it's not the fifth law. It's another angle on media moving out of the simpler formal dynamics of McLuhan's era. So then I say, this is like a scientific statement. The voluntary ESP extension led to the flip in the mixed corporate media environment, wherein the user is content, now consumed form, hyper-projection became the norm. So I was trying to explain how hyper-projection, that's summing up what you were thought was interesting before I did this last 5 minutes. That's what I was trying to get to, that people were creating the ground by projecting whatever content they were preferring. Mm-hmm. And right. That causes infinite fragmentation.
Correct. But it turns out that fragmentation is itself a form. So infinite fragmentation gets rid of fragmentation.
Yeah.
So that's, where Nietzsche left us in 1889 was with nihilism. And nihilism is the complete absence of everything.
And that's what my next quote is, what you just said. I say, the mixed corporate media merged beehive environment, involuntary, the hive mind, involuntary ESP, the global theater / membrane environment of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that had to flip, and it eventually reversed into fragmented voluntary ESP. So what I've been doing here, what I've been reading, is getting into Android Meme Phase 2, where I'm talking about environmental technological effects without any references to senses. So you begin with the non-sensory, the ESP. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm establishing the ground, let's say back in the 70s or 80s, during the global membrane, was a weird kind of collective knowing, a collective consciousness, a complex clairvoyance that McLuhan was asking us to get to and recognize and apply. Well, it's being applied, but it becomes quite anarchistic or chaotic as more and more shrinking media allows everybody to be their own ground. So that, you see, it's not an extension of the senses anymore. You could say the ESP is tactility, and that's a sense, but it's just an interplay of senses. And it may actually have frequencies that they'll be able to measure someday. Mm-hmm. But so does that explain to you what I'm trying to say here? Which you weren't
getting. Well, I think so, but notice how that gets back to what we said earlier about problems and solutions, right? This infinite fragmentation, this attempt of the individual to define things, which is absurd, because if the individual, him or herself, doesn't have definition, how are they going to go about defining?
Yeah.
Right? So you just end up with complete absurdity. So that complete absurdity is the sort of problem out of which McLuhan's solutions emerge. And if we don't allow those problems to be problems, then we can't understand his solutions. And modern or contemporary McLuhan research, or the EMA group.
MEA, Media Ecology Association.
Or Media Ecology, yeah, MEA, sorry. They exist by not taking McLuhan's problems as serious problems.
Yes, right.
And therefore, they can't get the solutions. So what you're doing here that I see is that you're trying to set up a way of seeing his problems as problems.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very important.
Yeah, and I'm establishing some science.
Right. Science can only emerge out of those problems.
Yeah, if people started saying, well, we all got ESP and didn't make an issue out and claim only special people had it, we had it technologically, that'd be an interesting point to begin with. Okay, we all know everything. We know what we're all about. Our unconscious is now figure. So we all got ESP. So what is there need to be said if we've all got ESP? What does it need to be pointed out? What is the where do the strains and pressures come from? Because they do come, and we should be on the lookout. When Marcel Duchamp went to Andy Warhol's factory, Warhol always put a camera in front of these celebrities, and they had to stare in the camera and like have a little confrontation with the effect of them looking at the camera filming them. But Marcel Duchamp, he didn't stare at the camera. He kept looking off to the side, you know, making his eyes go back and forth, over to the left, over to the right. Kind of like a paranoia thing, like, okay, you've got me distracted looking at the camera. What are you guys doing behind my back? So that's what I think that's a good image of. I lay out this new language, the ESP, establish it as the ground, and then you're left to look to the sides to see what's happening.
That. Correct. So Duchamp was making an important statement.
Yeah.
He was saying the camera is a point of view, but I, as a pre-tribal awareness individual, have points of view, points plural.
Yes.
And so the camera looks in one way, but I look left, I look right, I look up, I look down. And what I am is a way of dealing with media plural, whereas that camera is media singular.
Yeah, I'm not being seduced by it. I'm not being numbed by it. I'm staying outside of its effects.
Yeah.
So I just said the mixed corporate media merged beehive environment. So the mixed corporate media beehive environment, but it's merged, involuntary ESP, the global theater membrane environment, 60s, 70s, 80s, that had to flip. It eventually reversed into fragmented voluntary ESP. Then the next quote is McLuhan in Playboy. This is the content one. Okay, this is important.
Yeah. But let's just, for 1 second, let's just look back at what you said in the blue stuff there.
Yeah.
Fragmented voluntary ESP. Isn't that what we have in the media today? Is we have the news has degenerated into whatever some person says it is. So it's inherently fragmented, but it's voluntary ESP because somebody has decided that.
Yeah, we are integrated in the membrane aspect, but then we spiral off like subatomic particles to create a fake fragmentation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fake news. And,
correct.
And so people say, can we all get along? We are getting along, but we're not noticing the anti-environment to the ESP is to create a little problem, to make an issue out of something, which is futile, and will just end up people making money but becoming unhappy. Isolated. The new trend now, I don't know if you've heard, is to, if you transgendered yourself, is to get back to the non-trans. they're taking drugs to get back to what they were before they got duped into the trend and started changing themselves.
Yeah.
That's a new fact. So it really is important. I just think it's really important for people in high school to hear what we're saying, because they're not going to hear it anywhere else, not in the way we go into it. And they have an article they can look at. If the luckier kids, the ones who are just naturally attentive and interested in their lives, if they heard this, it would bring a bunch of words, science, that they could rebut their parents with. They'd make their parents have to get smarter if they could talk this way back to them. You know what I mean? And I don't think it's that hard to understand if it's spelled out simply, which I guess I'm trying to do here. So you're looking at Mao Zedong had his little red book or something in the 60s?
Yep.
We need to do that with this fucking book.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wave.
Well, sure. Well, that's what my version of Western civilization is, that everybody who's smart is trying to come up with their little red book, but nobody has done it yet.
Okay, so McLuhan and Gumbergalsi, he quoted Rabelais saying, "When I put out a book, I demand everybody to put down their plow, stop working, and read my book and
Correct.
Get it." So yeah. he saw the projection, literate.
Yeah.
The printing press was you start to project over the society.
Yeah, and that's like Joyce talking about Bloom's last thoughts as he falls asleep at night. And it's the one advertisement that nobody can pass without getting the message, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the same thing that you're talking about with Montaigne. So
with what? Montaigne?
Yeah, weren't you just talking?
Yeah, what were the two words you said? Wasn't Montaigne?
Yeah, Montaigne.
Oh, Montaigne, right, yes.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that what you're pointing out in the 17th century France is perennial.
Yeah.
Joyce saw it, Plato saw it. Everybody sees the need to try to come up with a dialectic in Plato's terms, where you can pass on what you're trying to say, but nobody has found a way to do it.
Okay, it wasn't Montaigne, it was Rabelais I was quoting. But,
oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
okay.
And Gumbergalsi.
Yeah.
So based on what you just said, so many people are seeing what we're talking about. They don't know how they got there, but they're seeing it. And so a lot of maybe the popularity of Jordan Peterson is people know that Jordan's not going to be able to come up with anything because he's using words. So they watch him not understand what's going on, not understanding the collective ESP, that all the anonymous, the moral majority, McLuhan called them, the great silent, the silent majority in the early 70s in arguing with Auden, the British poet, in 1971, that panel in Toronto that Bucky Fuller was on. The audience is the employer, he says in Take Today. The audience is the superior factor in the equation. It's not dumb people being manipulated to become consumers. That was the 40s and 50s, maybe the mall, epitomizing the mall culture. There's something has flipped, and the audience is watching and judging whoever shows up on the stage with their opinions, and they want to pick out what that person does that overcomes the inevitable error of the fact they showed up on stage.
Right.
All right?
He calls that the consumer becoming the producer.
Yes, yeah. So that mandate of everybody being a producer, the audience sits there and says, that guy almost came up with a correction of his error. That's where McLuhan says, my fallacy is wrong. The audience is deciding whose fallacy is wrong or right. So it's quite reversed now in what's going on compared to how McLuhan described the audience. So we have this content. He says in Playboy magazine, computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments. So that's the Venezuelan thing, which is happening naturally just as part of electronic society. The media ecology is being done, but it's done crudely and with no interest in the effects. Computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments to fulfill the social needs and sensory preferences of communities and nations. The content of that programming, and content is italicized, the content of that programming, however, depends on the nature of future societies. But that is in our own hands. What we were just all explaining, how we took over the projection, that comes out of that quote. So that is McLuhan in 1968. It gets published in 69, establishing the reversal that has happened. And you'll see him doing it in articles throughout the 70s, like the media approach to inflation in 1974, that New York Times op-ed. So one
way of putting this point is to go back to what we were talking about in the jungle, where instead of just grunts going on that merge with all of the other noises, that words are picked out.
That's the ESP.
Absolutely. The sensory perception is individual. That's pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah.
And when the other person speaks, that's external. Right? And that's what language is. Language is extrasensory perception that is understood.
Yes.
Between the people in dialogue. So what we see here with the word content italicized is that content, when it's individually defined prior to the individual definer having any reality, that content completely falls apart and leaves us with nothing. So what McLuhan is talking about here is, how can we get content that is not nothing?
Yeah.
How not only can this happen in the future, but how has it always happened in the past? And that, what could be called securing of content, is the great demand put on life now. How are we going to have news that is news instead of just manipulation?
Right.
So you can say that securing of content is what McLuhan is all about.
Right, not the securing of form, which is what they thought he was saying in the 60s.
Yeah. But that's stupid, right? I mean, if McLuhan says TV is not visual, it's tactile, then of course the TV you see over in the corner isn't what TV is.
Yeah.
Right? So that means that he was never talking about form in the sense that, oh, you just look over there and there's the form. He was talking about something very much more complicated. And the biggest complication was that there would never be an idea of form that wasn't content. There would never be an archetype that wasn't cliche.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can't have science.
So I wrote this article, booklet, to say McLuhan is important today, but it's the McLuhan you never heard about because he flipped on himself and you didn't notice.
Uh-huh.
The people didn't notice that he flipped his, and because here we are talking about content. You bring in an old fogey of old McLuhanism, Madison Avenue, and say, well, what do you mean? McLuhan never talked about content. That wasn't important. No, the environment merged and the content became form. So it's a both and kind of situation.
Absolutely. So just think about the phrase, the medium is the message, right? And so that can be taken in many, many, many different ways.
Yeah.
But the way that we're emphasizing right now is that the medium becomes the message. There is no access to the medium except this message.
And the message is content in tradition.
Yeah.
The medium is the content. So Let's end at that point. We've gone, I think, quite a long stretch here.
Fine, good.
I think that's, I'm looking at it. We're getting close to the end. Might take a couple months, well, many months maybe. But I'm quite far down on my bar. I'm at page 141, and it goes to 180. That's another 40 pages, so maybe it is a lot more. But compared to how slow we were going and how we were at the top of the right-hand bar, we're the locator, way back there. We've gotten down to the final lap. So
yeah, we're getting into some interesting stuff, so that's good.
Yeah, this is I did all the background to show that even the Madison Avenue stuff missed out old obsolete McLuhan aspects that no one knew he was talking to. Get that laid out. Then I come into the problem, which is where we're at now. This problem of whatever. What is the medium? What's the message? What's the content? And who's involved and what's being extended? That, I don't think anybody did that. If people, those people that in the 90s, 2000s, they started to notice and had to deal with McLuhan because of Wired magazine, they would often say, well, we need something that does, that's gone past McLuhan. Well, this is what went past McLuhan, but it's pretty hard to get them to pay attention to it. They didn't know where to go. They said, we need something to get past it, but we haven't found anybody that's done that. This might
all of these questions, in order to be even addressed as questions, require going through the vanishing point.
Yep.
And what people want to do with McLuhan, or what people want to do about Ukraine, or what people want to do about lawmaking or anything, all of these things are ways of avoiding going through the vanishing point.
Yeah. Which includes the collective consciousness. There's a knowing already. We've been massaged into a collective where we're actually getting along quite well. But the older analog media, they want to stick with the rearview mirror, because there you make money. If you go through the vanishing point, there's no more money.
Yeah. And this relates to McLuhan's communism, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the software communism. Okay, yeah. So very good. Let's see.
Top of 143 is where we start next time.
All right, thanks for telling me how to get oriented. That's right. We're going to get on 143. Yes, the top of 143. So thanks a lot, Cameron.
Okay, you too, Bob.
And we'll talk soon.
Yes, sir.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.